Welcome to Momentum Magnet, a podcast to inspire your growth. I'm Karen Morales, and your host in helping you find ways to make positive changes for your business, health, relationships, and life. We always have a path to a happier ending, so let's get started today. Hi, and welcome to this week's edition of Momentum Magnet, where we talk about hacks to help you get greater progress in your life, relationships, and business. Today, we are going to be running an update on a previous episode regarding the amazing scientific advancements we've had in the field of muscular dystrophy. As you may know, I am a patient myself. When I was 20 years old, I was diagnosed with a very rare form of muscular dystrophy, one you've probably never heard of. It's called limb-girdle muscular dystrophy 2B, to be specific. And given that today and this week is actually limb-girdle muscular dystrophy awareness week, I wanted to talk a little bit about the daily challenges of living with this disease and some of the amazing scientific updates that are happening in the field of CRISPR. When I was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy, I was 20, and I heard the following words: wait and see. I'm not sure. Nothing we can do. The science just isn't there yet, but you know, maybe someday. And in my 22 years since my diagnosis, we've taken leaps and bounds forward in every imaginable way. We've created social media. We have cell phones that are actually computers. We've even made our livestock create better milk outcomes. We've defined muscular dystrophy genes. We've identified the proteins that drive them. And we've raised hundreds of millions of dollars for drug research. But sitting here as a patient, it really feels like it could be 1998. 22 years later, and there is no cure or drug you can take to stop, halt, or ease the symptoms. There are no approved lifestyle changes, exercise programs, or even agreed upon supplements that any normal doctor will tell you to take. What I've experienced as a patient with a rare disease is a lot of disappointment, a lot of crushed hopes, and a sinking sense that I'm really in this alone. Self-advocacy sure sounds like one of those empowering buzzwords, but when you're managing a disease like muscular dystrophy, it feels impossible. I feel 100% responsible for my health. I have never been able to count on any doctor, nonprofit, or drug company to experience the same pressure I experience on a daily basis. I've been told I should be grateful it's not worse. I've received fear-inducing newsletter articles from the MDA with such amazing titles as How to Choose a Chair and The Reality of Marriage. I've been told by patient advocacy groups to keep quiet if I dare question pharmaceutical timelines that are so wrapped in secrecy. Balancing a degenerative diagnosis is an exercise in contradiction. Every single day, I'm grateful and thankful for where I am, but I'm also extremely frustrated on where I'm not. It's being thankful that I haven't lost my mobility or my independence, but still having to rely on a blue parking pass to get an accessible parking spot. It's walking in and crushing a big meeting and then feeling like I'm going to burst into tears when I can't get off of that rolling conference room chair or from a too low public toilet. It's being at a gorgeous spa and then realizing that ADA room I requested is actually only accessible from 21 stairs. It's being proud as hell that I delivered two babies naturally and then completely heartbroken when I can't get their sleeping bodies out of the car and up two flights of stairs. It was going scuba diving for the first time and then realizing that the only way to do it was getting lifted on and off the boat from the guide. And it's feeling unstoppable as a single successful mom and then that absolute crippling anxiety when you try to explain your pretty rare situation when you're dating. Life as a successful, fun-loving, and independent woman with muscular dystrophy is a life of contradiction. From moment to moment, I can feel limitless or limited 1,000 times a day. And still the hardest part is managing my own identity. accepting that my body and this current reality, it's just a daily struggle. I've been able to create so many dreams in my 43 years, a successful marketing agency, two beautiful children, a lovely home, traveling extensively, an incredible group of friends and family and colleagues. I've recovered from lost job, a lost marriage, family health struggles, financial strain, tragedy. But muscular dystrophy continues to be that daily burden I can't seem to break from. Living with muscular dystrophy feels like you're founding a startup. You know exactly what you want to create, and yet you can't find one existing model on how to get there. The trickiest part to accept is the drug development process. 5 years ago, I heard a gene therapy for my disease was created. Oh my God, it works in mice models. Finally, I qualified to be dosed, got the green light. I didn't have the antibody immunity that would leave me disqualified. And what happened? That was 2016. Now that drug sits in a lab 9 miles from my actual home. And I've been told that timeline, oh, I'm sorry. That's a complicated balance of profitability, drug approvals, and you don't get any information. It's really impossible to describe that soul-crushing feeling that a drug is finally ready and then it's not. So I finally said to myself, what next? And that's when I met Rich Horgan and Cure Rare Disease. We recorded an episode a couple of months ago that really takes us through the journey of how he created the first nonprofit to cure muscular dystrophy based on CRISPR technology. I'm going to let him describe it in his own words, but today I want to give an update from our story that was only 2 months ago. Rich announced this week that Cure Rare Disease was formally met with the FDA for the pre-IND meeting, the meeting that comes before drug approval. CRD received positive comments regarding their studies and their proposed plan to move forward, ultimately into the clinic for the first customized therapeutic. We want to thank the FDA for this validation and their guidance, which impacts our future for customized CRISPR therapeutics. So with this amazing news on this important week for muscular dystrophy and for science, I want to let Rich and my conversation from a couple months ago reach everyone so you can understand how the future of a cure for muscular dystrophy is finally in our sights. Here we go with that episode.
Hi, friends, and happy Friday. It's been a hard week in America. Another week with lots of sad news, tensions, and many discussions to push our nation, hopefully, forward. I found that discrimination is a really hard topic. And like most hard ones, it's a topic that most people would really rather ignore. It's always challenging to talk about issues that are polarizing, but in my experience, it's even worse when we ignore them. So today's conversation is not going to be about race, although we do plan to go there in a future episode. Today we're focusing on another challenge that some of us face, a physical challenge, a disability, scary diagnosis. It's something that I feel well-equipped to talk about because I received my own when I was 19. When I was 19, wearing platform heels and short shorts on my way to a Dave Matthews concert, I was told by the neurology team at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Boston that I had a super rare form of muscular dystrophy called Miyoshi myopathy. There were few patients, there was no cure, and they couldn't give me a very strong prognosis. During those early years in my journey, I did all the usual things recommended. I signed up for the Muscular Dystrophy Association to get information, and the only contact I had with them in those early days was one paper. It was a small magazine, one that you would print out and put on paper, probably, 40 or 50 pages in all, and it had two title articles. The first one was The Reality of Marriage, and the second was Choosing Your Chair. I threw that paper across the room that day, and I decided that was their story. That was their view for me. I didn't like it. So for the last 20-something years, I've been paving my own path. I've been researching with relentless optimism, every possible research, probability, outcome, drug, herbal remedy, exercise routine, meditation technique that could help me get better. And when you spend that much time looking for answers, you usually find them. And one of the answers that I found and I came to over the last year was Rich Horgan. Rich has a very similar family story to mine, and he has an amazing nonprofit drug company called Cure Rare Disease. So today we're going to dive into the world of scary diagnoses, of pushing your path forward, and how a business major from upstate New York started the first CRISPR fueled drug company for muscular dystrophy. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Rich. Hi, Rich. How are you?
Hey, Karen, how are you? I'm doing well. Thanks for having me today.
Oh, you're so welcome. You have a really interesting backstory. So I think I would love if you could talk to our audience about how you got involved with rare disease, with your journey with your brother, Terry.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to share. So for context for the listeners, my younger brother Terry, who actually just turned 25 a couple weeks ago, was born with a rare genetic disease called Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And for folks that may not be familiar with the disease, it's a rare disease, which means that it impacts less than 200,000 people in the United States. And it's a fatal disease, for right now anyway. There's no treatment, and no cure for the majority of the population. And so, much like your own diagnosis, there isn't a quite a positive outlook yet. And there's a number of clinical trials underway for different potentially promising therapeutics. But the challenge is that a lot of the clinical trials are geared towards younger patients or patients who are still able to walk. And so while my brother is, incredibly intelligent and completely quote unquote with it, he doesn't fall within these necessary inclusion and exclusion criteria that will allow him to participate, as do many patients. A vast majority of clinical trial pa of patients with rare diseases, even those other than Duchenne, aren't actually amenable to clinical trials. And so, knowing that we were quote unquote between a rock and a hard place, I took it upon myself to start the organization Cure Rare Disease about 2 years ago. I was finishing up my studies at Harvard Business School.
So this is it's a crazy story, right? I think we find often, because you and I have now spent a lot of time talking to other organizations that work with patient populations that don't have any current drug therapies available. And more often than not, a lot of the hustle comes from a family member on the mission. Can you talk a little more about how you felt that you could, I don't know, go there for your brother, especially given that you weren't a chemistry major. You were a business major, right? You hadn't studied science at all.
Yeah,
I mean, high
that's
school,
correct.
right? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean basic biology like everybody else, I suppose. But no, you're right. My background's in economics and then I have an MBA. But I think your point about being able to drive change because the situation affects you personally is what happened in this case. So no, you're right. I'm not a scientist, I'm not a PhD, I'm not a clinician, I'm not a bioinformatician. But I guess I have the gift for gab, you could say, because one of the things I was able to do, given the really privileged experience of going to a good business school here in Boston, was that I was able to connect with researchers from various walks of life and various research interests with the idea of potentially connecting them together. So the idea really came. It wasn't necessarily so linear, but it started to formulate during my last year at business school when I took a class at MIT with a really incredible person, Jonathan Fleming, who's a biotech executive and professor here in the Boston area, who said, "Hey, Rich, you should talk to this researcher named Tim Yu. He's at Boston Children's Hospital, and he's developing a custom drug for a little girl with a really rare disease." And so what became one conversation eventually blossomed into this idea of, can we take a technology and craft it so that it can help a single individual with an ultra rare genetic mutation? So if you think about rare diseases affecting less than 200,000 people in the US, ultra rare is generally defined as knocking a couple zeros off of that. So maybe 200 people in an entire country. Well, when you do the math on my brother's specific mutation, he's one of probably at most 45 patients in the United States with this specific genetic mutation causing Duchenne muscular dystrophy. So super rare. So the long of it, short of it is, in that coming out of that second year of business school, I had a great opportunity to become a Blavatnik fellow in life science entrepreneurship at Harvard Business School. And that really provided a great platform for me to kick off of. I don't come from a privileged background necessarily. And so being able to have the support of the Blavatnik Fellowship to allow me to take this risk, to build this organization, to pull together researchers, was a great launching pad for that. And so what became, you know, sort of what started as an idea quickly transformed into executing an idea with, you know, meeting some of our early key researchers, including folks like Monkel Leck, who's an assistant professor at the Yale School of Medicine, Brenda Wong, who's a clinician at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, and has been my brother's pediatric neurologist now for over 15 years. And so we started simple, right? We started with, can we identify the mutation clearly? And that answer became a yes. So we used a technology called whole genome sequencing, which is essentially figuring out where on a specific gene of interest your mutation occurs. So we looked at the dystrophin gene because that's what causes Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And so we identified it by taking a muscle biopsy. That's just taking a little piece of muscle out of the person and then creating what's called a cell line out of that. So that's essentially a patient in a dish, for lack of a better term. And in that patient in a dish, the team at Yale was able to experiment and develop a technology that would go on to later significantly or restore function of the cells of my brother's cells in a dish. And then that's really where cure disease started to take off, sort of at a exponential type of approach. After we saw that we could fix the cells in a dish, we said, wow, not only is this our only hope, but this is a really, really promising early find and early accomplishment. So we were really excited about that in the early days.
So Rich, you just gave us a lot of information. And for maybe some of the audience who isn't as savvy about all of the use of science to treat something that had previously been untreatable, let's go back a second and unpack a couple of the things that you said that I think are so meaningful and can be translated to so many situations in our lives. So you grew up, right, in upstate New York, and you didn't grow up in a huge town. You grew up in a small town. Parents owned a gas station and a convenience store, and you went to college really with this idea that you were going to crush it in the business world and someday be able to contribute to nonprofits to help treat Terry. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's completely accurate.
So he goes to college with this idea that he's going to make money and really give to the nonprofits that already exist. But somewhere along this journey, he actually decides to build one himself. So during your time at Harvard, you realized that you were surrounded by a lot of people with lots of means. And your first step was really starting a nonprofit and hosting what is the infamous kickoff party for the Cure Rare Disease fundraiser. Was that the first step that you took?
That's right. Yeah. So in the afternoon one day when I just got to business, when I was just starting business school in the fall semester, I sort of had this come to Jesus moment, for lack of a better term, of saying, wow, I really want to do something. I hadn't met Tim Yu, who I referenced a few minutes ago yet, or Jonathan Fleming for that matter. And so I said, you know what, I want to start on this journey of raising money for promising science. So kind of a continuation of what you mentioned a couple minutes ago with Cornell of, you know, achieving to raise money for a cause, not necessarily driving the cause at its core. So yeah, that's where it started. I said, you know what, I knew my parents had from the gas station business, good contacts in the fuel distribution business, and their fuel distributor used to raise money for another Duchenne nonprofit that my parents were a part of years ago. And so I called up my mom and I said, "Mom, how do you throw a gala?" And that's exactly where we got started.
It's so interesting how a lot of us entrepreneurs really start out our journey wanting to play a supporting role. And it's through the process when we don't like the systems or we don't like the speed at which things are getting solved that we decide to put ourselves in the driver's seat and take over. So that moment that you decided you were going to start this gala and raise money, did you have any idea where you would be directing the funds? Were you going to give it to an existing charity? Or is that sort of the moment the tide started to turn and you thought, maybe I could do something better with this money than someone else could?
Yeah, so it's definitely the latter situation here. I felt as though, you know, at the end of the day, what's the phrase? He or she who has the gold makes the rules. And so that's the drumbeat that I was operating towards. And, you know, you mentioned my family had been involved in small businesses their whole lives. Before I went to business school, our last small business endeavor was building a car wash. And so I think from an early age, kind of looking at it retrospectively, my sort of consciousness had a lot of independence and, you know, do it yourself type of mentality built into it. And so, you know, I felt who better to make a decision than somebody who has a brother impacted. You know, I don't think there is necessarily better motives. You know, I think a lot of times in nonprofit land, a lot of the sort of focus on the mission gets kind of kicked to the side a little bit as you know, administrative overhead takes over, as sort of competing priorities take over. But here I knew I had spent my, you know, my first semester and so networking with an individual who was a really well-known researcher, a luminary in the field by the name of Dr. Lou Kunkel. And Dr. Kunkel, you know, became and still is a great mentor and friend to me. And so, you know, Dr. Kunkel had this idea to look at doing a technology called cell therapy. And I don't really share the story often, but that's actually where we got started. And what the first gala went towards was trying to act as early catalytic capital for that research that would, you know, result in muscle regeneration rather than just pausing the disease or focusing on a segment of the population that my brother wasn't amenable to. This idea of cell therapy was a technology and is a technology that's, you know, very early still, but could be used to restore muscle to patients with varying diseases and even things like old age. So that's where we got started.
And that's really interesting because it's almost the same way that anyone would start a for-profit business, right? You are working in a market often, you see an opportunity, you go after it, and within the first couple years of bringing your idea to life, sometimes you have to make U-turns and left turns and right turns to change how you're going to solve the problem. And for you, that landed you in a different therapeutic realm, and you ended up thinking that CRISPR, which is super hard to explain, right? Lots of people talk about CRISPR in the world. And I think what would be our, I don't know, 6 or 7 word tweet to explain CRISPR to people that are not familiar? Cellular whiteout? Like, what? How would you describe that?
Oh, I guess I'd define CRISPR as clustered, regularly interspaced palindromic repeats.
But
in lieu of defining the acronym, I would essentially just call it genome editing, right? Essentially, what you're able to do with CRISPR is go in to a very specific area in the genome. That's sort of the zip code, if you will. You go to the right zip code, and then at that zip code, you make something happen. Either you knock something out or you add something in, and that should result in a positive benefit for an individual, simply put, a bit more than
six. So you find
points.
And replace or you erase.
Erase, yep.
Okay, so that's great. And as you made that turn, all of a sudden, your career also took a 180. So as you had been building this nonprofit on the side of your business school career, after this gala and after your increasing collaboration with scientists, you decided to make it your career. Can you talk about that decision on how do you walk away from something that you had worked your whole life to get to and decide that there's, you know, a different ending or a better ending?
Yeah, I guess the way I look at it is sort of, you know, what's the prototypical path that business school alumni follow? You know, one can think of consulting, finance, private equity, things like this, right?
Right.
And I'm not saying that those careers are easy. You know, they're very challenging and they have their own challenges. But to me, I had to go down a path that wasn't yet paved because the paved paths weren't really cutting it for my brother. And so, yeah, I think, you know, most HBO, I don't know what the median salary is, 130 grand or something, you know, astronomically crazy. But the moment that we started to show, you know, improvement in a dish is the moment I said, well, okay, this, you know, we got to go all in on this because you can't sort of go in piecemeal. And so I think, you know, I think about this a lot of like why people choose entrepreneurship versus why do people go with more traditional career paths. And, you know, I think the answer is pretty simple, actually. And it comes down to sort of like a couple of very specific moments. It's the moment where you have on your left an offer letter to sign for a salary that you're going to get paid week after week, as long as the business continues to go well, or, you know, continues. If you're going down a consulting path or an industrial path or something like that, it's a known salary and you don't have to worry about where that comes from. Right. That paycheck is going to be direct deposited every other week or every week, whatever your pay schedule is, regardless. Of course, now we sit in the middle of coronavirus here and it's shaken up a lot of things. But notwithstanding global pandemics, it's generally a much more reliable salary and you don't have to go find the salary. With the scariest part about entrepreneurship is that the salary that you get or don't get, it you get or don't get it as a function of your own performance. And so that's really scary, I think, for a lot of people. And it's scary looking at it for me in retrospect, but at the time I was like, this is great. I have the Bulvonic Fellowship that's going to give me a year runway and support, and then you're on your own. And I, you know, I think that to me was sort of enough comfort, to take the dive. But it is a scary moment.
Do you think there's something almost psychologically consistent in us entrepreneurs that we tend to trust ourselves more than anybody else?
Yeah, I think you have to have a very high degree of risk. Tolerance for this type of stuff. I think, you know, a professor broke this down really well for us one time in class. His name's Shikhar Ghosh. He's an entrepreneurship professor at Harvard. And he broke it down and said, you know, the probability of an individual starting as an associate level consultant, you know, like pretty fresh and reaching all the way up to partner is a very, very low probability. In fact, it's a similar probability as the probability of making a successful career in entrepreneurship. And you know, nobody ever thought of it that way. You know, to me, it's like, okay, you get your job, like you get your salary, you move up or you move out. But if you move out, it's to another equally or better paying job. Entrepreneurship, I would say if you sort of look at the risk profile, it's much higher highs and much lower lows. And of course, you hope there's much higher highs than lower lows. But I think it takes a personality that can insulate oneself against suffering the effects of the low lows and the high highs, because it becomes addictive after a while. I think if you look at like corporate type jobs, I would say the highs are lower and the lows are also much lower. So it's sort of a lower standard deviation of risk, or sort of like anxiety risk events versus entrepreneurship. But I think the other thing that Shikhar said is that you get addicted to the high highs when they happen, because it feels great when you win and you knew that you created this organization that's able to stand on its own two feet and compete among much larger organizations. You know, you feel that, whereas you give that up to some degree in more traditional jobs. So, you know, it does kind of come down to the risk profile.
Yeah. And it's that it's the personal element. I know, having worked in corporate America and having had my own business, while I've had wins in both and obviously failures in both, you can give yourself a lot more credit when it's your business, or you feel like the win is yours way more than you do if you're part of a larger organization, which
exactly.
Is apparently more fun.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's there's nothing like that feeling of creating something and seeing the plan move into execution, move into actually, you know, getting wins under your belt. There's no replicate feeling for that.
It's interesting because a lot of nonprofits get sometimes a bad rap for being more antiquated organizations that operate maybe, I don't know, on a business foundation that maybe isn't as agile or fast paced. I do believe that is changing, especially in the last 5 to 10 years, because it is so much easier to start any type of business, profit or nonprofit, from scratch. I mean, we have crowdfunding, we have the internet to connect us all. We have the ability to stand up an organization from your living room, your bathroom, your closet, and make it successful. But you had an interesting background because you had never worked in a nonprofit before. And your only experience outside of being a student was really working in corporate America, as well as your parents' various businesses. So do you think you bring a different perspective to the world of nonprofit, given the life experiences that you've had?
I mean, I'd like to think so. I think nonprofit is generally, it attracts a certain type of personality that sort of is consistent with the theme of nonprofit. And what I mean by that is the personality of doing good and doing well. I came into this with very different perspective. I think doing well and doing good is good, but it's a function. It's a product, not necessarily an end all process, if you know what I mean. I came into this saying, okay, I have this objective. I need to get this done. Very much so. This is the problem. How do we get to the solution? Okay, we have a nice solution identified. Now, how do we bridge the gap between problem and solution? I don't think a lot of nonprofits sort of see it that way. You know, I think depending on the cause that you look at, I think nonprofits.
And just to break that down more simply, I mean, you came with a really simple goal of, I want to cure my brother. I'm going to do it with CRISPR gene therapy, and then I'm going to make that scalable for other people like him.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and honestly, I didn't even care if it was CRISPR. I just said, okay, what can help Terry? What's got a good chance of, it's all risky. So what has the highest likelihood for a benefit here? And so, okay, it's CRISPR. You know, if it had been something else, that's fine too. I don't, you know, it doesn't really matter to me. I'm sort of technology agnostic, but that's exactly it. Yeah. What's the problem? Okay. Here's a potential solution. Now let's make it happen. I think some of the tough things that happen in businesses, whether it's nonprofit or for-profit alike, is you lose focus, and it's really easy to lose focus, especially with everything going on in the world. What if we stop to do this, or how about we add this? Well, all that takes away from the main mission. And if you're not dead focused on the main mission, then it's not going to work. At least in my experience, I think, you know, keeping that dead eye focus on getting the job done, no matter what, and no matter who, is just what you got to do. You just got to make it happen.
And that's really the truth. I talk to all of our clients about the fact that rigorous focus and a singular objective is the way to win. It's the way to win in your own life. So if you don't know what you're working towards, it's easy to get distracted by side hustles, or big companies decide to create 3 new product lines when maybe number one hasn't crushed it yet. But it is beautiful to see the simplicity of your vision and to see how quickly you've been able to bring this to life. And that's really, it's different than most of pharma. I know in my experience, there has been drugs in the pipeline for my disease for years, and they're still not great news on when they're going to be in the horizon. You have been working on this drug for Terry for about 2 years, and your timeline is to be dosing him by 2021. Is that still the vision?
Yeah, that still is the vision. And I mean, don't let me paint a wrong picture. You know, what we're doing is like anybody else who makes major achievements or tries to make major achievements, you know, we're standing on the shoulders of giants. And so, you know, we didn't discover CRISPR. Our team has sort of harnessed CRISPR for this specific use and driven it forward into a new application, and really a new field of trying to expand humanity's toolbox. You know, I think our goal, the way I sort of look at how do we fit into the ecosystem is, you know, at the end of the day, I'd love to be another tool in the toolbox of potential treatments for patients. You know, pharma pursues any number of diseases with sort of the traditional pharmaceutical model. You know, I'm not trying to replace that. I'm not trying to say we're trying to take eliminate pharma or become pharma. What I'm trying to say is, look, we need more tools in the toolbox because there's 30 million Americans impacted by rare diseases, by over 7,000 rare diseases, and only 5% of those have treatments. So let us be another tool in the toolbox that can help change that 5% to something much higher, because that's 95% of rare disease patients that are going without treatment. So there's more than enough room in the sandbox for all of us, is what I'm saying. And so, you know, I think where we've been able to do well is collaboration, and collaborating with individuals in for-profit instances and academic instances to take advantage of this wisdom that we're generating as humanity as a whole, to say, okay, we know we don't know all the answers to this because it's a new technology. It's never been systemically or throughout the entire body delivered. So how do we do it? And asking those questions and asking as many people that are relevant as possible has helped us to gain new insights to say, okay, well, we shouldn't do this. We should do this, that instead, because, you know, that former path has been tried and it's not so productive. So, you know, I really do think it's about open collaboration, really being willing and able to talk to lots of different people and have challenging conversations. It's about communicating with people to say, you know, we know you're in a different situation, but, you know, what did you do here? How did you think about this? And taking advantage of that group wisdom is something that's allowed us to move quicker. And I would say, you know, just the decency of humankind. I think, you know, you started off this podcast saying we're in a challenging time now, no doubt about that. But I think when you look at the, not the silver lining, but sort of when you look for the good in humanity, you know, we've seen that a number of times throughout this journey, even though it's been a couple years, to see people who, you know, have competing interests say, yeah, you know what, this is more than about money. This is about lives here, and be willing to share and be open with us when it matters, because all the knowledge that a company accrues doesn't do humanity any good if it's all contained within one vessel. And so people specifically in the biotech industry have been very forthcoming about helping us, which is really great to see.
Yeah. And from what I understand from you, it is a different model, right? So there are a lot of diseases that impact millions or hundreds of thousands of folks in the United States. And a lot of the bigger drug companies are set up on the foundation that they treat many people with one thing. And the way that rare disease often works is there's so much variance in these diseases that are also super rare that it's almost like you can't do a one size fits all treatment, right? It has to be like the custom suit for each of these patients. And because of that, you have been able to have a lot of collaboration in the pharmaceutical space, because while you're a competitor, you're also an outlier.
Yeah,
you're
exactly.
Reaching different patients. Yep.
Exactly. Yeah. I think when you look at rare diseases, to your point, you're right. One size fits all oftentimes doesn't work here, especially in the case of Duchenne muscular dystrophy. So if we can figure out a process to develop therapeutics that are customized to an individual, even an individual that is the only person in the world with that disease, that's pretty powerful, because then it's not necessarily a death sentence that you're born with a disease that you're the only one with it. And therefore, you know, sorry, you just drew the short straw on the type of disease you had. So that's what we're trying to fix, is so that nobody's left behind.
Now, I know you're not a fortune teller, but you have spent a lot of time thinking about this pipeline and the future of custom therapeutics. For the rest of us in the United States, when do you think this will really take hold and we will begin to see the difference and see these options across the disease states? Is this 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the pipeline? What do you think the timeline is for custom therapeutics to really be a major offering for most rare diseases?
It's a really good question. I wish I knew the answer. We're trying to make that happen sooner rather than later. But what I would say is that what society generally sees as sort of nothing, then all of a sudden a huge, you know, uproar or a huge sort of incidence, is often not the case. Oftentimes it's a lot of action happening out of the spotlight that eventually leads up to a point where then it demands and pulls the spotlight over to it. So, you know, there's a few other family groups that are working on custom drugs just for their child. we're trying to take it and say, okay, you know, let's fix one, use that as a proof of concept, and then scale it up. So right now we're sort of in between the finishing the proof of concept and the scale up phase of this development. So, you know, what helps one will and must help many in the future. And so, you know, I think there's a few big bottlenecks to getting from where we are now to getting it sort of, as you described, of being a common tool in the toolkit. You know, I think one of those is showing that it can happen. We've had a couple success stories. You know, we need a lot more so that people start to see it and it's in people's faces. And then secondarily, we need to pave the path for reimbursement. What we do is we're a nonprofit who raises money from grassroots campaigns, as you know. But the challenge is that, you know, this a drug customized to an individual costs around $2 million. 99.99% of people just can't write a check for that, my own family included. And so what we have to do is fundraise. Well, to have this happen at scale, what you need is you need to have insurance companies reimburse these approaches so that it is much more scalable. And if you think about it from an insurance point of view, if you have a disease that's going to end up costing insurance companies many millions of dollars, as many rare diseases do, when you look at the cost of drug, the cost of treating the symptoms, the cost of going to the doctor, of physical therapy, of lost hours not working, of the burden on the family. Now, that's not all paid by insurance, but it is paid by society. So if society can start to see that these costs are huge and that, you know, for a couple million bucks right now, we can alleviate a significant percentage of that spend downstream, well, then it starts to make economic sense. And I think if it starts to make economic sense that this should happen, then it gives it a great tailwind to be able to push it forward into a much larger scale. So, you know, there's a few bottlenecks, but that's what we're trying to tackle one at a time, saying, can we do this? That's what we're trying to check now. So far, so good. Can we convince insurance companies to reimburse even just a few pieces of it? We're working on that now and trying to build that into the initial proof of concept. So these early steps, I hope, set a strong precedent for future projects. I know that even when you look at, you know, our first proof of concept compared to our second patient we're working on, the time that we're able to get from point A to point B, you know, and what we can make up the details of the time from characterizing the patient to developing a therapeutic has fallen. Instead of it taking, you know, 6 or 7 months, the second one took, 4 or 5 months. And so, you know, the time is starting to come down. So with decreasing time, it's also decreasing cost. And as some of these big bucket technologies that we're using, not to get too technical, as the price falls of these technologies, that makes it even more approachable. And so, you know, right now at you know, time June 5th, 2020, we are, you know, we're at $2 million, but those costs will fall too. And so there's a lot of tailwinds that'll help propel us into continuing to move into the mainstream. And, you know, that's everywhere from mainstream East Coast, West Coast to especially in the heartlands of the United States and more globally, that this is not only possible, but it is a economic and socially smart path to pursue.
For the personalized therapeutics, are there any other countries that are really pursuing them, or is the US kind of paving the way?
So that's a good question. I think from what I understand, and I don't have I can't speak for everything that's going on, but from my understanding that the US is really driving the path forward on this. The United States is, in my opinion, a super unique country for a couple of reasons. The first is that we have a higher willingness to fail and a higher tolerance for failure. Failure is not bad. Failure is what you learn from and how you make the next attempt better, right? Whether it's a failed business, a failed project, whatever. The next one should be better if you learn from your failure. We also have a unique a regulatory agency, the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. Now, in recent years, the FDA has begun to change their perspective of being overly restrictive, potentially, to being more willing to work with drug developers to get to the clinic. Just because we haven't 110% understanding of everything about the therapeutic and how it works, it's okay. You know, people like to joke that penicillin wouldn't have been approved 20 years ago, whereas it was approved, you know, decades before in today's regulatory climate, because of some of the burdens that we're seeing decrease now. So, you know, there's the United States is uniquely positioned because we have extremely smart talent. We have access to capital. We have regulatory agencies that are willing to work with us And we have patients here who are incredibly courageous. I mean, it takes a lot of courage to put yourself through this type of thing as a patient. And so I do think the U.S. is, at least right now, the epicenter of customized drug development. You know, I hope it continues to spread because I don't think it should be restricted to just the United States. But a lot of our social fabric, I think, enables for this type of approach to potentially work.
Yeah, and the recent continuing COVID crisis has caused a lot of disruption in, you know, every aspect of the United States, including drug development. So when I'm thinking about COVID, and we hear a lot in the news about how they're, you know, helping some of these pharmaceutical companies get to vaccines as quickly as possible for the use of, you know, the global population. Do you feel like there'll be any sort of helpful tailwinds for people pursuing things other than COVID based on some of the green lighting and the fast tracking of what's happening right now to combat coronavirus?
Yeah, I think to some degree. I think, you know, the regulatory path that we're taking is one of compassionate care. And so when you take when you develop a drug for an individual, there's less concern from the FDA because the FDA is an organization that needs to ensure public health, right? And so public health is a lot of people. So if you've got a drug that's going into tens and tens and tens of thousands of people, there's going to be a lot more scrutiny from the FDA than just one person necessarily. And that's not to say that there's no safety assessment. There's no efficacy assessment. There are safety and efficacy assessments, whether you're treating one human or, you know, a million humans. But they do look at it and say, okay, if this doesn't work, what's the impact? They want to avoid situations like thalidomide, which, you know, you might be familiar with, was, I think, a morning sickness drug, you know, in the 30s that caused severe birth defects. They want to avoid things like that, rightfully so, it's their job. But I think what we've seen with COVID is a relaxing of some of the over pedantic interests or details of the FDA. Generally, it takes 10 years and $2 billion to develop a drug. Yet here we stand hearing on the news.
10 years and $2 billion. That's
yeah, it's a lot of time and it's a lot of money. And it's oftentimes because you're trying to develop a one size fits all for many people. And so you're trying to find the magic key that unlocks a lot of doors instead of finding one key that unlocks the specific door that, you know, is of your concern. So, you know, we've seen an expedited review process from the FDA come out of COVID. We've seen the FDA working more hand in hand, or the federal government working more hand in hand with drug developers, rather than it being an adversarial relationship. We're continuing to see a trend of a cooperative relationship, again, back to collaboration, which is exactly what we want to see. And I think a number of these policies will stay around because we're seeing that we can develop drugs really quick when we focus on it. You know, whether or not we'll get a vaccine for COVID in 2020 and 2021, I don't know, but I'm sure it'll be one of the 2 years. And even just to make that stake in the ground to say, like, yeah, within a year or two of this crisis breaking out, you know, we've got a vaccine and the game's, you know, we've won. It's incredible. It's incredible. It takes years to develop drugs, but when you focus on it and when you really dig down and collaborate, you can get stuff done really quickly.
What kind of pivoting did you have to do during the lockdowns over the last few months?
So we've done a couple things. Obviously, the cancellation of a lot of in-person events have been really challenging, not just for us, but pretty much all nonprofits out there. So we've pivoted to a couple different things. Gaming and esports has been a pivot we've made. We brought on a great consultant from the space who has allowed us to engage with talent, engage with publishers, engage with multiple aspects of the ecosystem to drive awareness and fundraising. So this month, the month of June, actually, Method, which is an esports organization, is donating all the proceeds from their fundraisers that their streamers do, people who play games, to cure a disease because they like the mission. They get what we're doing and they think it makes a lot of sense. And we'll continue to do things like this. We'll continue to reach out to other gaming organizations and esports organizations to deliver the message of this is what we're doing. Our followers are incredibly on brand for this because a lot of our followers are differently abled. They can't necessarily go out and play basketball, baseball, but they sure as hell can play Call of Duty. And they can play Call of Duty just as well as you and I and anybody else. Because
Maybe better.
Probably better, yeah. I got to put my glasses on when I play nowadays. But yeah, exactly. So it's very on brand. Another thing we've done is look at, you know, how can we how can we take, you know, how can we partner with other nonprofits creatively to be able to drive change, right? You know, I don't want to be the only one alone doing this. And increasingly, we're seeing interest in the space from both pharmaceutical companies as well as nonprofits who are trying to move things forward. So, you know, gaming's one example. Collaborating deeper is another example. You know, we just keep our ear to the ground of new things that we can do to help propel the effort forward. You know, in the coming weeks, we'll have a nice appearance on national TV, national radio. So things like this, where we can continue to deliver the message that, hey, you know, don't forget about rare disease. Our people are still dying here, even though COVID's taken, you know, less so now than maybe March and April. But there's still people dying despite a pandemic going on of diseases that aren't related to the pandemic. So, you know, we can't forget about those people either, especially when we can see how much progress we can drive in a short period of time when we really focus on it. You know, if you take that same focus and diligence that's been applied to COVID and apply it to, you know, muscular dystrophy or ALS, well, I think things could be very different in a very shorter period of time, right? You know, I think the gene was cloned in 1986 for muscular or Duchenne muscular dystrophy, yet, you know, progress for treatments has been relatively limited, I would say, in that period. So, you know, I think maintaining that heavy focus, again, you know, the importance of focus, is something that we can apply and learn from COVID to other diseases.
That's amazing. So, Rich, if people want to follow your journey and your story and get more involved with what you're doing for muscular dystrophy and other diseases, how would they get information or donate to your cause?
Yeah, absolutely. So folks interested, and I encourage you to reach out, you know, whether you or your family's impacted by rare disease, or, you know, somebody that is, you know, reach out and learn more. Our website is curerarediseases.org. And our social media handles are all the same, being Cure Rare Disease. So you can follow us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, website. We do occasional webinars on overviewing what is customized therapy, going a little bit deeper. And it's also a great chance for corporations and other individuals who are interested in philanthropy to make a tangible difference. I think one of the very unique things about what we do is that you can trace where all the dollars go. You can see how we spend, what we spend on. And you can tangentially or very tangibly have an impact on the outcomes of individuals' lives. So if you look at our website, you know, you can see the people we're helping. If you look at our social media, you can see pictures of the people we're helping. And so, you know, this isn't a sort of a black hole for funding. You know, it's very finite levels of what we need to raise to get a job done. So, you know, I sort of look at this and say, okay, well, sort of cognitive dissonance that I usually have with donating to nonprofits is I feel like the mission never ends, that no matter how many, you know, things we do for the specific mission, it's never really over. But here it's quite different, because here what we're doing is we're developing therapies that fix the root cause of the problem. And it's a one-time shot, a one-time therapy. We develop it. It takes about 2 years and $2 million. And the person's, you know, genetic mutation is corrected. So no, I absolutely encourage people to reach out and learn more and get involved. You know, I think, you know, again, if we can take the same focus that we've had for COVID and apply it to other rare diseases, man, we could really make a very big difference in within our lifetimes, I should say.
I have no doubt you will make a very big difference. So keep in touch with Rich. His journey has been impressive. I also serve on the board of Cure Rare Disease, so I'm involved in this cause because I believe in Rich, I believe in his team, and I do believe that customized therapeutics will be one of many pathways to bring more answers and more cures to people. So if you have a family member, a friend, a colleague who has someone in their life with muscular dystrophy, they can also sign up, and there'll be some new patient education resources coming out soon, as well as always the opportunity to donate and follow. Well, Rich, I really thank you for your time today. Happy Friday. I hope you have a nice weekend. You brush up on your Call of Duty skills for these gaming tournaments. And we will talk again soon. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Really appreciate the opportunity.
Take care. Goodbye, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to Momentum Magnet. We're here every Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time to share inspiring comeback stories. We want to hear your reviews and love getting your subscriptions on iTunes and Spotify. For show notes and past episodes, visit MomentumMagnet.com. keynotespeaker.com. I'm Karen Morales, keynote speaker, writer, and founder and CEO of Marketing Magnet, a fast-growing marketing agency for purpose-driven companies. Whether you are a business needing an agency, or if you are looking for weekly tips to get ahead, sign up at marketing-magnet.com to receive our weekly inspiration on getting more in your life and business.